Hello and welcome to Film Weekly. I'm Jason Solomons. On the show this week, I'm joined by comic legend John Landis. We'll be discussing his landmark horror, An American Werewolf in London. On a small budget but sticking with the wolves in Romania, director Peter Strickland from Reading headed east to make a dark tale of revenge, Catalina Varga. I'll be finding out how Peter turned a modest budget into a lavish first feature. Zan Brooks will be here. He and I will be reviewing Disney's 3D animation Up, Goodbye Solo from much-lauded American director Ramin Barani, and a lo-fi comic gem. Shane Meadows is back with Le Donc and Scorsese. Yes, it's much better than walking into the slaughtered lamb. It's Film Weekly.
Excuse me. Well, what's that star on the wall for?
You made me miss.
Sorry.
I've never missed that board before.
Jack, we better go.
Are you kidding? I'm starved.
There's no food here.
Shall we go, Jack?
Apparently so.
You can't let them go.
How much do we owe you?
Nothing, lads. Go. God be with you.
The groundbreaking comic horror of An American Werewolf in London there. Directed, of course, by John Landis, the man who'd given us Animal House, Trading Places, Three Amigos, who could forget them. I caught up with this directing veteran to discuss the re-release of his comic horror gothic fantasy British-American classic.
In 1981, you know, Margaret Thatcher had not yet driven her stake in the heart of the British film industry.
Right.
American Werewolf is I don't know if you know this, but it's an Edie picture. It's the last Edie picture. Do you know about the Edie plan?
Yes. Lord Edie had made this kind of a friendly agreement, a cordial agreement.
Well, it was an interesting agreement. It meant it was a fascinating one that was very successful for a long time, which was if you qualified for British content, you got a percentage of the UK box office that would go to taxes, went back to the producers. So it was really kind of a tax rebate kind of thing.
Yeah.
And it was incredibly successful in terms of getting production. Do you remember London in the 60s was booming because of it? And that was all American money.
Yeah.
You know, Werewolf, which is unusual, is British money. And it was an Edie picture, which meant that other than myself and... So the writer and director, who was me,
yeah,
was American. George Folsey, my partner, the producer, was American. And the costume designer, my wife, was American. And the makeup guys, Rick Baker, were Americans. But at that time, that was new. There were no... Now there are quite a few people in the UK who are very fine at special effects makeup. Then it didn't exist, so we could get them in. And they actually, Rick actually trained a lot of people on that show that are now the top people in England.
Right.
But so, other than the two boys, the cast was entirely British and the crew was entirely British. And we shot in London. So,
I suppose the key scene of that film that everyone remembers is the Piccadilly Circus scene. And I still think you're the only person that ever managed to get the traffic stopped in Piccadilly Circus to film there.
Well, you know, it's an interesting thing. We only had the traffic stopped. We could only stop it three times and only for 2 minutes at a time. Did you know that?
No, I didn't.
It's basically what happened. Something that is true is that we were the first people in a long time to really shoot around metropolitan London. And that was because the infamous Michael Winner made a film called The Jokers in the 60s. In the late 60s, early 70s, I've forgotten. But it's Oliver Reed and Michael Crawford,
yeah,
and Orson Welles. It's about stealing the crown jewels. And when he made that film, Michael, without permission, put a big smoke bomb and pyrotechnics in a taxi in Piccadilly Circus and had hidden cameras and shot the chaos and stuff. And this was at the height of an IRA bombing scare.
Mm.
So, you know, the government and the police were not happy with Mr. Winner. And essentially what they did was say, right, fuck off. Nobody's filming here now. And so for many years, no one was shooting. You didn't see London. You know, no one shot around town. And it was because the police just were not amused. You know? The other interesting thing that really struck me as odd when I got there was at that time, there was no such thing as film permits or a film, you know, office or anything. What they did was, if you shot on location in London, it was literally down to the bobby on the beat. So if he said piss off, you couldn't shoot there. And it was quite difficult because, you know, now this every city in the world wants you to shoot there and they go out of their way to help you. But at that time, they were not interested. And I had just gone, literally had just gone through the same experience in Chicago. Because on the Blues Brothers, a picture I made before Werewolf, I wanted all these, we saw the movie, we did all these huge chase scenes and things in the city of Chicago.
Yeah.
So we were given great permissions in Chicago and had great cooperation with the cops and everything.
Even though you totaled like half the city's police force cars, I think, in Blues Brothers.
Well, we didn't, but it sure looks like it, doesn't it?
Yeah.
You know, the big secret of the Blues Brothers is we had a 24-hour body shop going. And we had about 52 cars, and we used the same cars for the Chicago police, for the Lake Wazapamani police, for the Illinois State Troopers. And you saw each car was in at least 25 collisions, so it looked like we were trashing thousands of cars. But that's a secret.
No, I won't tell anyone.
Okay. But so when we got to London, we went to Scotland Yard and the Metropolitan Police, I remember. There were like three different... That was the time of the GLC.
Yeah.
And, you know, it was like a separate country, separate government. You know? We went... It was complicated because it was the GLC, the Metropolitan Police, and Scotland Yard. But essentially, we built a little model of Piccadilly Circus. We showed with little toy cars what we wanted to do, and I explained how we could do it. And the assistant director, David Tringham, had a map he made, and we showed them what we wanted to do, and they basically said, fuck off. What helped us was I called the cops in Chicago who had helped us do the big chase stuff, because the stuff in Chicago was huge and far more complex and dangerous than the stuff in Piccadilly Circus. The Chicago cops came through and spoke to the British cops. And so they said, all right. And then what happened was the Blues Brothers opened. And I literally had a wonderful thing. I had a screening. I don't know if it was the Empire Leicester Square or the Odeon Leicester. I think it was the Empire. It was one of those giant cinemas.
Yeah.
I had about 300 cops, all the British police officers and traffic managers, and they all came down and watched it. And basically they said, how the hell did you do that? And they were so, they luckily for me, they loved the Blues Brothers. And they said, all right, well, maybe we can do this. And what we ended up doing was, we were only in Piccadilly Circus two nights, and only were allowed to shoot between, I think it was between 1 and 4 in the morning. And even then, it was very strict. We were only allowed to actually stop traffic for 2 minutes at a time. And so what we did, we worked it out so that it was kind of like, have you ever seen a Grand Prix race?
Yes, I have.
You know when the cars come in for their pit stop?
Yeah.
How the teams are so well rehearsed, they rush out, and they take all the tires, they do all the stuff, and boom, you're gone again. So what we did was at Broadlands, which was, I think it's, is that a racetrack or a... someplace outside of London.
Yeah.
We had all the vehicles, and we rehearsed and rehearsed and rehearsed so that we could essentially do the big crash, the one that involves about, I think, 17 vehicles. It's the one you see it, you know, it's the one where the bus turns and all the cars crash, and you see the big wide shot. That big crash, we worked it out so we could do that. And then once it was done, we could clear the street in a minute. And then get ready to do it again. And we got very good at it. And so we had, you know, the circus literally, you know, was pretty easy to control because it's all coming into one hub. You know, what we did was we literally did it and did the shot. I think we did it twice. We did it twice and then cleared it. And then the other stuff I shot didn't involve traffic control. It was on sidewalks and everything. And yeah, that was all pretty easy.
And dashing into the tube station. And
Well, the tube station, we shot at the tube station.
Yeah, so that was all right.
But the whole Piccadilly Circus sequence, it was 2 days or nights at actual Piccadilly Circus. And then the other, most of it was shot, what Les Dilley, the art director, we replicated, we built a set at Broadlands that was the corner of Shaftesbury and Piccadilly,
mm-hmm,
where there was the cinema and Bureau de Change, and I forgot, there were like 7 or 8 shops. We built that corner, put a traffic island, and we only built it up a story and a half, not very big. But that's where we shot all the tight stuff. So when you see the Piccadilly Circus sequence, yeah, it really is cutting. It's shot in 2 different places,
yeah,
made to look one. And it works very well.
It works brilliantly, and it's still one. I mean, I have a London film slot on a London radio station, and people often talk about that, what iconic London film scenes, and your one comes up. So, you know, that's, you're alongside, like, Alfie and you know, some of the great London films. Always people talk about American Werewolf in London as being an iconic London movie, and it is part of the city. You know, that's what when you say no one had shot around town, it is very much a London movie. It's not just an American's come and he's put a red bus outside the Houses of Parliament and fucked off again. You really were part of the fabric of town. You know, there's London Zoo, and it feels like a British movie.
It is a British movie. Mm. Well, one of the problems I had was I wanted it to look like London in 1981.
Right.
And at that time, the unions, you know, were still pretty strong. And one of the problems I had is I wanted extras who were black and Indian and Pakistani, you know, and there were no colored, or you'd call them colored there. There were no colored extras in the extras union. And in fact, there's a very funny story about when George Lucas showed Star Wars to all of us here in L.A.
Yeah.
That was a picture shot in London.
Yeah.
And when I looked at it, I said, George, are there no colored people in outer space? Is everyone in outer space a white man? And George went, oh, my God, because he hadn't even thought of it. It's just that when you shoot in London and you ask for extras, you got all white extras. That's why certain what they call ethnic actors, I mean, do you notice how throughout the 50s and 60s and 70s, every Asian person in a British film is Bert Kwok? It's because he was like he was the only guy who was Chinese.
Yes. Yeah, it's interesting you say the kind of, I suppose what we call them, racial tensions now that are in American Werewolf in London, because it is, well, it's a comedy and it's a horror as well, but it is, it has got a social function.
I'm not aware of the racial tension, but there certainly is. It, you know, I was there for 1981, was the Brixton riot.
Yeah.
And I wanted the movie to just look like London. And in London, it's a mixed society, like Los Angeles and New York, you know. And there are all kinds of British people living there. And that's what I wanted it to look like. And I remember I had quite difficulties because they just wouldn't let me.
So what did you do?
And finally, I just said, look, I'm taking the picture. It's going to be an American Werewolf in Rome, you know. And it was a very complicated thing, and that was the only real problem I had before we started shooting.
And so when you threatened to go to Rome,
we were going to say American Werewolf in Paris.
Right, but funny enough, you did do that, didn't you? But
well,
that was,
I didn't. No, someone else did.
They did it like 30 years later. So,
exactly.
But but you managed to get some what we used to call colored extras.
Yes, absolutely.
Then.
No, then finally they let me, and it was fine. You know, I just felt that I wanted it to look real.
Yeah. Thanks to the living legend John Landis. Their American Werewolf in London is out on Blu-ray. It's re-released on the big screens on October the 30th for Halloween. Beware the full moon, ladies and gentlemen. And John Landis has joined me in the director's chair. You can catch up with that video interview on guardian.co.uk/in the director's chair. Zan Brooks joins me for this week's reviews. We'll be looking at Goodbye Solo, we'll be looking at Disney Pixar's 3D animation Up, and we'll be looking at Le Donc and Scorsese. Zan, welcome back. Nice to see you.
Thank you very much.
Let's take you back to that opening night at Cannes when everyone donned the sunglassy kind of 3D specs to, with their Dickie Bows to go and look at Up, a cartoon, basically.
It was a scandal. It was a scandal that rocked Cannes to its foundations.
The very fact that a cartoon opened the world's most prestigious film festival.
Whatever next.
Have Disney and Pixar elevated the art of animation so high?
Yeah, I had no problems with it at all, in fact. You know, who cares if it's a good film? And Up is a good film.
Why is it a good film?
Why is it a good film? It's funny, it's touching, it's moving at times. This is voiced by Ed Asner as a 78-year-old man, widower, called Carl Fredrickson, who's being forced out of his family home and tethers helium balloons to the home and jets off to have the kind of adventures that I guess eluded him in youth.
Only there's a little Boy Scout stowaway. Here is young Russell talking to Ed Asner's Mr. Fredrickson.
Are you in need of any assistance today, sir?
No.
I could help you cross the street.
No.
I could help you cross your yard?
No.
I could help you cross your porch?
No.
Well, I gotta help you cross something.
No, I'm doing fine.
Good afternoon. My name is Russell, and I am a wilderness explorer in Tribe 54.
Slow down.
Wet Lodge 12.
Kid!
Are you in need of
Thank you, but I don't need any...
Before this, Zan, there is a moment where Mr. Fredrickson looks back on his life with his wife, a little sort of, I suppose it's 2.5 minutes of kind of reminiscent cartoon. I mean, it had people in tears.
Yeah, I think it certainly brought a lump to my throat. And cartoons aren't normally known for doing that, maybe. It's utterly beautiful. It's captivating. It's a wordless little montage that takes us right through from their wedding right through to his wife's death, touching on the subjects of their childlessness. And it is wonderfully, beautifully, subtly done.
And do you think that's what makes up what it is because the humans, I mean, normally cartoons are about either toys or rabbits or kind of, you know, animals kind of saving the forest or bugs and stuff. This one's actually about real people.
Real people. And if anything, it makes the film top heavy, I think. I think that the first half of Up is flawless and moving and special. The second half, it does descend, I think, literally and metaphorically into the jungle. And you get a slightly kind of R. Rider Haggard-style adventure when the Ed Asner character meets this renegade rogue explorer called, I think, what's his name, Charles Muntz, who's gone native, a little bit like Kurtz in the jungle. Played by Christopher Plummer. And he has a team of dogs. And I like the dogs. The dogs are funny. He has this team of dogs which he's kind of wired with collars that allow them to speak as humans and give them slight human sensibilities, even though they're still dogs.
Yeah,
so they're a little
bit
stupid.
I didn't like the dogs.
The
dogs lost it for me. I thought the monkey in Cloudy with a Chance of Meatballs, Steve, you remember our favourite
monkey
Steve. Who had the kind of speakertronic thing. I thought he was funny. These dogs, for me, that kind of lost it because it was going back to the kind of cartoon animal
thing. I quite like that.
Did you like the bird Kevin?
No, I hated the bird Kevin. Rubbish. The bird Kevin was like Big Bird out of Sesame Street.
Yeah,
and
not funny.
Not funny, and I guess the sort of the Jar Jar Binks of Pixar, wasn't he? He was just annoying. You wished he'd go away. But the dogs I liked. I liked the Doberman
Russell,
Pinscher.
The little boy was a bit annoying as well.
The more we talk about this film, the more we're coming down on it.
No, I don't want to. I sort of have an issue with it. I did have an issue with it with Cannes opening with it as well, and I've sort of been against it ever since.
But you go in, you have a slight Pixar animation prejudice, don't you?
Well, I don't. I mean, I saw Toy Story the other week again in 3D, and I think it is a kind of bona fide, nailed on, unadulterated classic that 3D has sort of neither helped nor hindered, really. It didn't really sort of make it any better. I thought it was brilliant already because the story was great. I just thought that the comic world of Up, as you say, in the first half hour, I think is there. It's great. They're in the house, they're flying over, I thought the scenery. But when it lands and has this sort of Apocalypse Now adventure, it kind of lost it for me. It stopped being funny.
There's rather a lot too much running around. And shouting.
I thought happened in Bolt as well, the other Pixar film about the dog. And again, that was almost funny, but then it was just running aroundy stuff.
Yeah, it's I really liked Up. I wouldn't say it's the absolute top of the Pixar animations, but it's, you know, one rung down, and that's good enough.
It's not bad. So thumbs up for Up in general, but we don't want to get down too much down on Up. Let's change pace amazingly to Goodbye Solo, though set in America as well. It's the story of a Senegalese taxi driver, Solo, who picks up a gruff old man who wants to be taken to a high point called Blowing Rock from where he can commit suicide.
You said Blowing Rock, right? You want me to take you 2 hours from here on top of some mountain where you're not meeting nobody and you don't want to come back? That's what you said, right?
I told you all this before. I don't want to repeat myself to you and every cabbie in Winston-Salem.
You have a big dog, you know, this is kind of strange. You got to give me that, right? You know, you want to talk about something?
I mean, forget it. I'll call and get another driver.
No, big dog. No,
forget it.
I'm your driver. Come on, I'm your driver, man. Don't call the other drivers. They're not good. I'm telling you, they're not good. Don't call them. You know, just that. What are you going to do there anyway, man? Are you going to go camping? Are you going there to chill with the trees and the birds? You like birds, big dog? Are you going to fly away? You're not going to jump, right? You're not going to do that, man. Tomorrow's going to be a better day, you know? You're just going to the movie now, see a nice...
$100 deposit. The rest also in cash on October the 20th when you pick me up.
Red West as the gruff old man and Suleiman Sinsani, is that right?
I think so. It's very interesting that you describe this as a total change of pace for Up, because I think it's a kind of weird little companion piece.
I suppose you're right,
they
actually.
They should put these on as a double bill.
I think
they're
right.
Both about an old man who's lost the will to live, who meets up with a younger male who maybe shows him the way forward.
You're right, although I actually think this has got more in common with last year's The Visitor. Do you remember with Richard
Yes,
Jenkins,
it is like that, yeah.
Who kind of befriends the kind of
triple
immigrants.
Bill.
A triple bill, then. This is directed by Ramin Barani, whose first film, Man Push Cart, I saw, which is a kind of existential tale of an Indian kind of hot dog seller. I didn't see his second film.
No, me neither.
Chop Shop. And this, again, I thought was kind of interesting kind of look on the twilight life of America. And there's not many filmmakers who are dealing with these kind of, I suppose, what we call immigrant workforce. Presumably he's illegal, Solo.
Yeah.
It's a very good mind to seem to mine, it seems, as a director, because America's full of these stories.
Yeah, I think so. And this is obviously what Barani does. It's what he did in Man Push Cart. It's what he does here. I like this a lot. I thought that this is a great, almost anti-buddy movie.
Yeah.
Because it's set up as the odd couple. You've got Solo, who's, the young cabbie who wants to be a flight attendant. And you've got William, played by Red West. I keep saying Fred West, which is really
it's
unfortunate.
A different film.
who's the cantankerous old guy who gets into his car. And these people are separated by the years. They're separated by race. And they're also, you know, separated by disposition. And yet they arrive at a sort of uneasy truce that's never really Hollywood. It doesn't go the route where they're completely buddy-buddy.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And I was sort of reminded of The Visitor in the kind of old-timer befriends kind of lively immigrant kind of genre. I did like this one, but I thought it was a bit downbeat, I have to say, in a sort of purposefully way, to the point of being eventually underwhelming. Much as I like something that avoids a Hollywood ending, I sort of went, there was like,
I agree, and I think that he's very deliberately
Don't let me bring
avoiding...
you down again with my kind of general misanthropy today.
He is deliberately avoiding the Hollywood ending, and that worked for me.
In the way that you see Hollywood
endings
coming.
It was so predictable, the fact that it wasn't predictable.
Exactly. I knew that this was just not going to be happening. Red West is an interesting character. He used to be a bodyguard for Elvis.
Yeah, apparently so. And fell out with the king after I read something that he broke the foot of some guy who was bringing Elvis drugs. And Elvis was so angry that he dismissed him. But of course he was trying to save Elvis.
From himself.
Yes.
Yeah, absolutely. I did like the kind of twilight view of America.
I like the small town, which is, I think, Winston-Salem in North Carolina.
Which is where Ramin Barani comes from, apparently.
Yes, apparently so. He's an Iranian filmmaker. His parents were Iranian and moved over there. And it's a part of America that rarely gets on screen.
Let's go British now for more lo-fi filmmaking. Ludonk and Scorsese. Shane Meadows making a mockumentary to kind of vie with This Is Spinal Tap. Scorsese is a rapper he's discovered in Nottingham. The faux music impresario cum roadie, played by Paddy Considine, has got him a gig opening for the Arctic Monkeys at Old Trafford Cricket Ground.
You know, I did manage to get you in the hotel tonight. Yeah. So we're all going to have a night together tonight, because I know you can't start work till tomorrow anyway.
Fuck yeah, mate. Sweet.
But obviously you'll be in the camper tomorrow.
Appreciate a Mondo.
Yeah. So you'll be obviously back in there tomorrow when you're on site.
Yes.
So that's the deal. I'll let you, you know, obviously we'll let you stop in the hotel tonight as long as, you know, you're moving to this tomorrow.
What do you mean?
You're stopping in this caravan.
I thought I was in the hotel with you guys, favoured nations.
No, because the film's obviously you're meant to be living in this.
Why don't you put me in the room tonight? Dean sleeps with Dean.
Yeah.
Right. Tomorrow, Dean has the rascal, and I sleep with Derek. In his place where he slept tonight for the next two nights, so at least I'm in the hotel with you so we can party every night.
Well, you've got to be on... From what I understood, you've got to be on site. I thought you were sleeping in the back of your car initially. That's what you told me.
Say that.
You did?
Yeah, man. This is you fucking manipulating me, man. You're trying to... I know what you're trying to do. You're manipulating me, saying things I didn't fucking say. You're trying to capture them on your camera, man, to make your film interesting.
I'll cancel the room.
On the road with Shane and Paddy once more. Are you a fan of the Shane Meadows lo-fi aesthetic?
I am. I think this maybe tested it a little bit, but I'm still a fan. I did like this.
Yeah,
I'm liking them all this week, aren't I?
Maybe because you like this, because it's funny.
It is funny. Paddy Considine is very amusing. Yeah. Maybe it's a bit of a well-worn archetype that he's trotting out here, of the sort of the deluded roadie who fancies himself as a star.
Is it? Have you seen a film about that, though?
I don't know if you've seen a film, but I must have seen a film. I've come up with a film in it. But it's you know, there's that Saxondale, wasn't there? There was that Steve Coogan.
Apparently there's... I've saw Paddy sort of talking about, they know Saxondale, they've been practicing this character Ledonk for years.
No, so they got there first.
So they got there first, and yeah, sort of right. Even showed it to Steve Coogan.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Ah. And but they won't kind of, you know, press it. But there is Saxondale, which I thought was actually quite good as a Steve Coogan character.
Yeah.
But I thought Paddy Considine was terrific in this.
Kind he
of
is very
committed
good.
To this improvisation. I mean, it really is sort of just a 5-day improvisation with Paddy Considine.
Yeah.
But he's very funny.
He's good. Again, as with Up, I thought that the first half of this film worked better than the second. I thought when it was concentrating more on Paddy Considine rattling around his house that he's renting out to the students and some old guy that he wants to get out.
With an egg on his jumper.
Egg on his jumper. And going around to his ex-girlfriend's house who's now pregnant with his child. All of that little human comedy I thought was beautifully done.
Yeah.
And arguing with Shane Meadows, who obviously does appear as Shane Meadows in the film.
In a sort of Nick Broomfield.
I don't want to look like a meanie in this. Don't cut me so I look like a meanie.
Yeah.
And all that sort of that meta fiction I thought was very nice.
There's a great line where he says, I feel like Donnie Darko going under the cover in the Mafia and all that.
Yeah, when they wire him with his mic. All that was great. I thought when it finally gets up to Old Trafford and it's the, as Paddy Considine's character calls them, the Arctical Monkeys, all of that began to... The film's appeal began to ebb away a little bit.
Didn't you like the bit where they're kind of practising the rap in their bedroom?
Oh, yeah. And it's still got great bits in it. Yeah. It's got great bits in it. And Scorsese himself, I thought, was a very nice house guest in this film.
Isn't he good? He's good, I think. He's a good rapper. Good. I really liked his stylings. I liked his beats.
And he's a very unprepossessing, pleasant, amiable character to have around.
Isn't it? He's sort of like Shane Meadows used to be. I mean, Shane's lost a lot of weight looking at
the
film.
Shane Meadows is probably a little more forthright and upfront than Scorsese,
yes.
Who for a rapper seemed almost to kind of be happier hiding in the background.
He's kind of prone, isn't he? This is a sort of out-and-out comedy. It's a bit of a sketch of a movie, which I suppose one doesn't want to bestow greatness on something that is, I suppose, so slight. Because normally Shane's films, there's always humour in the banter, but there's always threat that comes in, be it racism in This Is England, or be it kind of, you know, violence in something like Dead Man's Shoes. That's what is absent from this, that kind of takes it onto a bigger plane, I suppose.
Yeah, it's a very gentle film. It was famously shot in 5 days, which... you know, means that you're working with time constraints. It's never going to be fully developed, fully realised. It comes in at something like 71 minutes, which I guess a lot of people are going to object to paying however much you pay in a Western cinema.
You said that about Summer's Town as well. Which
I liked Summer's Town as well.
They're very affectionate towards their characters as well, I think, Shane's films, which I think is what one likes. And it recaptured that spirit of his early shorts, which people like, that Small Time and Where's the Money, Ronnie. So I mean, I did enjoy it very much, and I would watch it again. Do you think it's... up there with This Is Spinal Tap as a documentary?
No, very few things are up there with This Is Spinal Tap. Possibly you might even say that This Is Spinal Tap isn't up there with This Is Spinal Tap anymore, because so many people are making mockumentaries now.
Yeah.
It's become worn from overuse. And as much as I like this, I wish that there'd be a moratorium on mockumentaries for a couple of years. Let's call it right from now.
Rupert Brown, a.k.a. Scorsese, a.k.a. Scorlazy. Rupert Brown.
Zan Brooks, thank you very much. As ever, if you want to keep up with Zan's musings on the world of film, go to guardian.co.uk/film.
Stop chatting backwards in a Ford Sierra with leopard skin seats.
Vă rugăm deschideți, poliția.
Bună seara. Vă rugăm să ne scuzați că vă deranjăm la ora asta atât de târzie, dar ați întâlnit cumva o femeie pe nume Cătălin Varga?
A taste there of Catalina Varga, the debut feature of British director Peter Strickland. It's set in Transylvania, and the film tells the tale of a mother, Catalina Varga, and her son, Orban, on a journey into the Carpathian Mountains in search of revenge for a past wrong. And joining me now to shine light into this dark, mysterious narrative is director Peter Strickland. Welcome to Film Weekly, Peter.
Thank you.
You're from Reading, is that right?
Yes, yes.
Okay, but this film is in Romanian.
Mm-hmm,
okay, mm-hmm. What's a nice boy like you doing in a place like that?
Well, for some reason, I think outsiders can bring something to a different location. I think some English films I've seen that have been made by foreigners, such as Control or My Summer of Love, they have a certain quality.
Yes.
And I know Ricky Gervais is doing this Cemetery Junction film in Reading. I think he has more experience. But for me, I would love to make a film in Reading, but I just don't feel I'm ready. I don't have the tools. I'm so familiar with Reading. And strangely, I grew up in that town,
yeah.
But the films I watched always reference that part of Europe. So Tarkovsky's films, Parajanov, Herzog's films.
Yeah.
So I think for some people making films, you just respond more with what you're seeing on the screen than with what is around
you. Is it that you'd imbibed those films so much that that is how you saw film? That if when you spoke film, that's how it came out?
Yeah, absolutely, yeah.
So I think this is a tale of one woman's journey to right a wrong that happened to her way in the past. She takes a young son on a journey to the Carpathians to track down some peasant people who've done some terrible wrong to her in the past. One whom she finds is still a reprobate, another has turned into a gentle giant of a man, and this is where the shifting morality of the tale takes place. She actually finds she might quite like this bloke who's done this rotten ill to her, but then tragedy ensues, almost as it must do. There must be some sort of moral fallout to this tale, but in fact the wrongs that are righted are not necessarily the right ones.
I think that's real life. I think this idea of justice is somewhat fabricated. Justice is not always dealt.
Yeah.
And I feel filmmakers are cheating the audience if you always have a happy ending. I remember going with a girlfriend, and I remember she left me, and we went to see Notting Hill together.
Is that why she left you?
I just felt cheated at the end. I wanted Hugh Grant to be just left alone. And I think unhappy endings are very cathartic. I think you feel spoken to if you have experienced some kind of injustice.
Well, you know, it's a folkloric tale, isn't it, in a way? It reminded me of Asif Kapadia, who's from Hackney. He made a film called Far North, set, of course, in the Antarctic, which was almost a folkloric tale. The wind was a big factor in it. The nature was a big factor in it. And in fact, this tale, I mean, the way you shot it, the Kodachrome colouring, the kind of saturation of it, it could be set in 1956. There's a mobile phone that rings occasionally that reminds you, actually, you're here and now. But, you know, Catalina and her son, they're on a horse and cart. They're going through this kind of, you know, eternal landscape that probably hasn't altered since time began, almost.
But I think that is Romania now, and it's very interesting. It's one of the few places in Europe which is in transition. And at the beginning, we wanted to make a period film. I wanted to reference some of the films I loved, but obviously the money just wasn't there. But the more I went there, the more I realized that look at it. It's fascinating. People are genuinely using mobile phones on horse carts, and it's not some contrived anachronistic device. This is how it is. And since it's joined the EU, it's really on the border between the old Europe and the new Europe. Right.
Can we talk about the sound of it? I mean, mm-hmm. which I think is just extraordinary. The music that you use, the sounds that you've got in there. Trying to look through the credits as to who these people were. They were slightly new to me. And I know. I noticed at the end that you won an award in Berlin for outstanding achievement in sound design, which sounds like they tried to make up a prize to give you because they thought the film was rather extraordinary. And it is. I mean, the sound is really kind of crucial to this film. I assume it's almost another character.
It's okay. I think I really respect the sound designers. They did a great job, but I think more credit should go to the musicians because a lot of the music is not music, and people think it's sound design, but it's actually music. This scene with the bird song—it's actually a record from my record collection from 1982.
What is it?
It's called Chiconia by Nurse with Wound, and that's a piece of music concrète. But because it's not melodic, people still, I think audiences still have to grapple with the idea that music can still be non-melodic.
So just give us an example of what sort of music there, because there's obviously there's campfire kind of gypsy music.
Yeah, there's gypsy music, this very traditional music.
And did you source that while you were there, or was that something
that was recorded live, actually. Two pieces of music were recorded live, these two gypsy pieces.
Using a local gypsy band?
Yes, yes.
Can I ask, I mean, when sort of London filmmakers, I'm talking about Asif Kapadi before, who went to make The Warrior in India because he had this great, grand, epic vision. And of course, to make that in London would have cost a fortune with extras and street stopping. But if you go to Rajasthan, obviously you can get a million extras for like a very, very, very sort of quite reasonably. Assuming that your budget was made much cheaper by going to Romania.
Yes, but at the same time, even if we had millions, I still would have chosen Romania because of the location, because I trusted Hilda, I trusted the actors.
Yeah. How much, can I ask you how much the budget of this film was?
It was £30,000 to shoot and edit.
£30,000?
Euros.
Euros.
And then an extra €70,000 to do the post-production. So the sound and the lab work to scan the 16mm negatives. So I think that
100 grand all in?
106.
106. To you, 100. Go on, give me 100. You've got haggle. I think it's an amazing kind of piece to have such kind of resonance for such little money.
But I think it's possible. I think I hope that it encourages other people to do this. So this was all in because I think many films. I don't know. I mean, this is my first film, so I don't have much experience. But I do think budgets are too high, and you could spread it around a lot more and people could make really good films on very little.
Your film's better than Transformers 2 Revenge of the Fallen, I've got to say, and that cost a hell of a lot more. So congratulations on Katalin Varga, Peter
Thank
Strickland.
You. Thanks very much.
Thanks to Peter Strickland there. His film, Catalina Varga, gets a limited release here in the UK from this Friday, October the 9th. And that's all for this week. Do pick up a copy of this Sunday's Observer. No trailer trash this week. Instead, I'll be writing about the revival of the American indie film. The music featured in this week's podcast is from the excellent score to Disney's Up, written by Michael Giacchino, previously best known for his score to the TV series Lost. Do join me as well on our Facebook group, Film Weekly Fans. But for now, from me, Jason Solomons, and my Film Weekly producer, Jason Phipps, it's goodbye.